I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This episode is brought to you by Vertera Dinnerware. Learn more at Vertera.com. That's Vertera.com.
It's September, and as the days get shorter and temperatures cooler, it's time to go back to school. This week on Meet and Three, we're looking at how lunchtime is changing from elementary schools through college, whether classes are remote or in person.
While there was some information about where families could access food, it was spread out on many different websites.
I'm seeing people, you know, advocate for like going back into school, and a main reason is, you know, food insecurity. Like, kids go to school and they get fed, and that's a whole other thing of like fight for kids to be fed versus like going to school.
Tune in to Meet and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live from the Lower East Side of Manhattan on the Heritage Radio Network. As usual, joined by Nastasia the Hammer Lopez. I think you're live from Stamford right now. Is that true, on the coast?
Nope. I texted you last night. I am in the Hamptons.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You're in the Hamptons. I didn't know if you were still there or whatever. But it's basically you're looking at the same body of water, right? Because you're staring at the sun just in the other direction. Oh, you're on the other side.
The ocean. The Hamptons are on the ocean.
I thought both were the Hamptons.
No.
What's the other side called?
North Fork.
Yeah, whatever. and joined by our intrepid customer service representative, John. How you doing? And John, you are not in Alpine because your cooking charge, you were cooking for Djokovic, and that throat ball took him out of the running. And so, you know, for those of you that don't know, this one of the world's most famous and, you know, I guess best tennis players got ticked off, swatted a ball, hit a line judge in the throat. She went down, as we were discussing beforehand, like the grape lady from the thing. But unlike the grape lady, hadn't done anything wrong. Didn't deserve to get hit in the throat with the ball. And so he was, even though it was unintentional, he was instantly disqualified, right?
Yep. Instantly.
Yeah. And so then, you know, you were no longer making the room temperature quinoa as a result. Is that true?
That is true, too. Yep.
Let me ask you a question. I know that like he hightailed it out because he didn't want to talk to anyone because everyone felt bad about the whole thing. But do you get the impression that he eats room temperature stuff only during training time, like a boxer does? Huh. Or is this like an all the time kind of a sitch?
I don't know. That's a good question, actually. I should ask my friend about that. Yeah, I don't know. That's a really good question. I hope he eats happier food when he's not training. But who knows?
Yeah, I mean, because, I would do it for the amount of money that he made. How much have you said he's made lifetime in tennis?
So far, $750 million.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I would probably eat with an IV, you know, for the duration of my career, if that's what it took, you know, for that kind of money. But, I mean, unless you're making that kind of money and all you're doing is, like, tucking into, like, unspicy room temperature, gluten-free grains on 20%, you know, all the time, I'd be like, oh, jeebus.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, what are you going to do with all that money if you're not enjoying it? I guess he doesn't enjoy the food, maybe. Maybe he doesn't enjoy food. I don't know. Anyway.
He did come out with a cookbook, like, 10 years ago, so I think he enjoys food to some capacity.
Did you read the cookbook?
Yeah, we did. But it's so out of date because it had gluten recipes in it. It had fish and other things in there. And he doesn't eat any of that anymore. So,
but he wrote the book?
Well, I mean, supposedly, yeah.
as much as one does when you're that famous.
But it has his imprimatur on it.
Yeah.
It's been stamped by his errant tennis ball, so to speak. So you should take a look at it, analyze the recipes, and let's get back and see whether the guy even theoretically at one point had a love for food.
Fair. I can do that.
Because I'm interested in knowing. Yeah. So then before we went on air, last night I did the public lecture for every year Harold McGee and I go and we start up the Harvard Science of Cooking lecture. Harold's been doing it for 11 years. I've been doing it, I think, for like 9 or 10. And we do a public lecture, which is not the same as the class. And then we do a, the student lecture, which I have to do later on this afternoon. And this time they did it on Zoom. And I think they're going to make it available, but I can't find a link. So Nastasia was asking me how it went. And let me just say that trying to do Zoom with like demos, and like, so I was trying to do demos and share a PowerPoint and try to run my infrared thermal camera to do demos all at the same time off of one computer. And that is, don't do that. let me just go ahead and say, don't do that. Nastasia would have loved like just seeing in the background.
The chaos,
yes. Yeah. Like, you know.
Oh, yeah, you want the behind the scenes video, yeah.
She wouldn't even sit there. She'd be like, Dave, you're not doing your demos fast enough. Dave, your demo.
Wait, where was Jen? Like, was Jen helping you or Dan?
Yeah, well, even so, but like still, like the problem is that like I needed to be at the computer, so it's not like Jen could be at the computer, and it's not like I brought her in like 8 hours beforehand and walked her through every step of what I was going to do, because at that point, I didn't even know what I was going to do. You know how I am. So like I had to, but she, even with her helping me, it's just trying to funnel your entire brain when you're doing your camera, your overview camera, and this was without OBS because I'm doing it straight into Zoom, and like a PowerPoint, it just doesn't, it's hard. Anyway, so I learned about that, but I did in the process, and Nastasia, I used the lecture as the starting point to run actual experiments that are going to be in the actual moisture management cookbook. So you'll be happy to know, or unhappy, I don't know who has money on me which way, but one of you, hopefully, will be happy to know that I'm officially doing things that are going to be in the book. Not just thinking about it like I have been for the last couple of years, but I'm actually running experiments that are going to be in The Miracle of Moisture Management, working title. And actually, I'm going to use some of that information when I'm talking later about one of the questions people have today. What are you doing in the Hamptons Grill? You've been grilling?
No, I'm here with...
but like, how are you cooking? Are you cooking inside or doing? You're still doing outdoor cooking?
We're not cooking. Not cooking.
That's another way to cook. Is to have other people cook. And,
yes.
You know, some people's favorite way of cooking is to have other people cook. So,
yeah.
And Matt, presumably you're still in the Rhode Island.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've been hosting my mother-in-law, whose favorite way of cooking is to have other people cook. So I've been doing a lot of cooking. Nice. I kicked my own mother-in-law out of this house so that we could do this show and you wouldn't hear her. So you're welcome.
That's a strong move. And, let me just say that I feel
that... Or maybe
that,
I should say thank you.
Yeah, I feel that we're tight enough that you can use me and Nastasia as an excuse. Like, hey, look, mother-in-law, it's not me. It's these other jerks. I'm going to kick you out, so you got to get out. You can use me like that.
Yeah, also they recorded other episodes, 1 p.m., 2 p.m., 3 p.m., 4 p.m. It's scheduled all day. You have to leave.
I think Nastasia and I are fine being the bad guys for this. So, Nastasia, are you fine being the bad guy for this?
Always. Yeah. Hey, want to hear something weird that happened this morning when we were biking back from the beach? I was talking about how a lot of people believe that Prince is around them, you know, like his ghost. And then I was like, I don't really understand it. And then, boom, a transformer like burst and the power lines like started shaking. And everyone freaked out on the street. It was crazy.
And so, okay. That seems like an amazing coincidence, people who are listening, until you realize the fact that about 90% of what Nastasia says for the past month has been this thing about Prince. So 90% of the time when you're talking to her off air, it's like you're sitting there.
Dave, that's such an exaggeration.
Any silent break that you have, like if you're just sitting there with Nastasia and there's like maybe like you know, 5 minutes of silence while you're doing something.
There's never
like, you
5 minutes
know,
with you, Dave.
She'll be like, you know, this thing is Prince. They think everything's a Prince.
Yeah.
So in other words, believe it like, not.
And now we have proof. It's true.
Well, no, but I'm saying, like, if the average person, right, out of nowhere was like, you know what I read on the internet today for the first time in my life ever, and I've never thought about it before, is all of these celebrities who feel that that Prince is haunting them. And then, and I think that's a load of malarkey. And then, boom, a thing blew up. That would be a coincidence for the ages. You know what I'm saying?
That's basically what happened this morning is what I'm telling you, Dave.
Uh-huh.
That's what I'm telling you.
I'm happy to believe.
Thank you, Matt. Yeah. Try it. Like, talk to your mother-in-law about it and see what happens.
Yeah.
Nastasia also says that among certain people there is, and I didn't realize this, but it's also a plot line in the most recent season of Billions.
The Prince thing?
Billions. No. So, like, the birther movement is that terrible thing with, you know, we all know what that is. But what's the equivalent movement called for Stevie Wonder Can See? There's an equivalent terrible, and that is also, as a joke, making the run of the celebrity things and was recently featured in Billions. So, like, you know, that one's never going to, you're never going to get anything.
The people on Billions said that Stevie Wonder Could See?
No, they mentioned it as a crazy like birther like thing. It came up like 2-3 times in the most recent season. Yeah.
Uh huh. Wow.
Yeah. People, Stevie Wonder cannot see. Like, I don't even know where that comes from. Where does that crazy?
Like, a lot of people think. A lot of people.
Well, the important thing is that someone in Nastasia's family also shares this view. But OG, way before anyone else was talking about it, way before this was a thing. There's a person in Nastasia's family who's been like the whole time, you're like, that dude.
Well, so I think in Prince's book or somebody's book, he says that he thought that Stevie Wonder could see because at the Four Seasons Hotel in some country, Stevie walked straight to the elevator after checking in and pressed his floor. And someone was like, or maybe Prince was like, how did you do that? Or how does he do that? And Stevie's like, I memorized all the layouts or all the Four Season layout hotel layouts are the same. So I memorized it. And everyone's like,
Well, not to mention, I mean, elevator go ding. You know what I mean? Elevator goes ding.
But still, Dave, like, I don't know.
And here's another thing.
How do you find
You know what Stevie Wonder
bank?
Probably doesn't do? Walk by himself. Anywhere.
No, the
dude
point
is famous.
Of the freaking story
entourage.
Was that he was walking by himself. I'm
no entourage. I'm supposed no to believe entourage. That Stevie Wonder had no entourage.
When Prince's ghost comes back to me, I will ask if there was an entourage.
I'm also going to say that not every, you know, like ground floor of the Four Seasons, like they can't all have the same layout. I believe he's blind.
I have
but
no idea.
That seems a little far-fetched.
What's to believe? It's a freaking fact. This is what happens nowadays in this kind of post-truth crazy world that we live in.
Dave,
that you that,
the
that
Atari
you could legitimately
ad.
That what?
The Atari ad.
Oh, well, that's just a fake. That's a fake. It's probably like Nastasia and I got fooled years ago by a fake ad where it was like 2 years ago, wasn't it? We got fooled by a fake ad that someone did from the 70s of Stevie Wonder, much younger Stevie Wonder, ostensibly advertising the Atari 2600. But it was funny because we thought it was real at the time, and we're like, I can't believe that the 70s were so horrible and offensive that they would do this.
And his people
kind of
let
thing.
Him do this. Yeah.
And yeah. But it's all fake anyway. But you can go
but
look it up.
After we had sent it to people, being like, look at this. Yeah.
Look at this crazy thing. And they're like, I knew we could see. although the premise of it is that he can't see. But the point is that I can't believe that we live in a world where John seriously has to say, I believe that he can't see. Right? I mean, like, where, so like this crazy freaking theory has enough legitimacy that you actually have to take sides. You know what I mean? That's like, look, I believe that the sky is blue, but, you know what I mean? No, sky blue. Sky is blue. You know what I mean? Like, it's like Earth round. You know what I mean? Like round-ish. Mostly round. Very round.
Because in December, it was Shaq. It was Shaq who saw him walk into an elevator. Yeah, that was the thing.
It was who? No,
Shaq said that.
Oh, Shaq the basketball player?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then he told that to Prince and it made it in Prince's memoir? No. Are you reading Shaq's memoir?
No. Shaq said it on Inside the NBA, that show. And he said, I'm going to tell you all a Stevie Wonder story, but you're not going to believe me. And then he said, we live in a building on Wilshire Boulevard. You can park your car in the valets down there. I'm already in the building and coming through the lobby. The elevator door opens and it's Stevie Wonder. And he says, hey, what's up, Shaq? Presses the button and goes up. Yeah, and he was like, how did he know it was me?
I mean, I don't know. I don't know. But the explanation is probably in Anthony Shaq's Anderson, memory of this.
Anthony,
you know what
Anderson
I mean?
Also said on the Stephen Colbert show, what y'all don't know is that Stevie can see, it's just an act. Even fellow music icon Lionel Richie believes the theories are true and expressed this on the Kelly Clarkson show.
This Kelly Clarkson has a show? This is all ridiculous anyway.
I feel like they were all just hanging out at a party together at one point, and then they were like, hey, you know what would be hilarious
if we start
tried
this
to convince
rumor?
The public? Yeah. And Stevie was like, yeah, go for it. It sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Stevie Wonder's probably saying, like, whatever, man. You know what I mean? Whatever. You know what I mean? I don't know. So ridiculous. The whole thing is so ridiculous. I mean, I can't even. Let's talk about cooking. I can't even. Let's just file this on a I can't even. Question that I have for the cooking issues people out there who are listening. This is my question where I get to ask it because it's not anywhere online that I can find. So this is one where I've actually attempted to Google the answer to it. I asked the manufacturer of the equipment, right? And I still was not able to get a satisfactory answer. So look. Nowadays, it used to be that when I was working at the FCI, that the holy grail of kitchen scales was a kitchen scale that could do a large amount, let's say like 10 kilos, but do it to a relatively accurate level, let's say a tenth of a gram, right? And I found an old one, and I bought one, and Nils Noren, you know, who was running the school at the time, he bought one personally. They eventually broke, and I didn't have them anymore. And the main problem with having like a very fine accurate, one of the main problems of having a very fine accuracy and a large weight range is that the larger the weight range, usually the bigger the plate that's on the scale. And the plate on the scale, if you try to do things that are very accurate, like, you know, a hundredth of a gram, let's say, air currents in the air literally move the thing around, and it's hard for it to be super stable. Now, the other thing that it changes the inherent accuracy of the scale is what's called the A to D, the analog to digital chip. So what they're doing is that as you push on a scale, there's a little thing when you push on it, and it's changing the resistance of it's a force, you know, the oh my God, the word of her just went out of my head. But anyway, it's changing the resistance, it's putting a voltage through, and it's measuring kind of this very tiny voltage change and then converting that into the weight. And so an A to D chip, something that takes that analog signal and turns it to digital, has a certain range, right? 24-bit, whatever it is. And so the minimum amount that you can read is limited by the signal-to-noise ratio, like how good is the circuit, and B, by how many digits it breaks the scale into. All right. So usually you can't have a large plated scale that measures things that are very accurate because of the wind. The A to D chips have a certain range, which limits it. And also, even if you have a range, the larger the range, sometimes the longer it takes for something to settle out at the right thing. So some scales are slow to settle. They take a couple of seconds to settle, whereas some are very fast. Okay, so that's the background. Now, nowadays on Amazon, you can go buy a 5 kilogram, 5,000 gram scale that does a hundredth of a gram, right? 0.01 grams. So it can do drugs and hydrocolloids and also like anything up to, 11? What's 5 times 2.2? 11, right? 11 pounds, right? Which is awesome. And you can get them for like $125. If you go on eBay and get the factory seconds from the same company shipped direct from China, you can get it for $60. Now, they sell the same scale as 5 kilograms all the way down to 600 grams. So almost an order of magnitude difference. They all look the same. What's the difference, right? On the flip side, I bought for myself a 30 kilogram scale. So I can measure CO2 tanks. I can measure 20 pound CO2 tanks without a problem. I can put my oven on top of it, my Breville air oven on top of this scale and weigh it with the food inside. Get this, to the 10th of a gram. Now, I have a 30 kilo and this same exact scale with the 10th of a gram goes from 30 kilos and you can buy one with a weight range all the way down to only 5 kilos, right? So what's the difference, I said to the manufacturer, between the 5 kilogram and the 30 kilogram? They're like, well, you should always get one that measures a little bit more than you need. I was like, no, specifically, is there a disadvantage to getting the 30 kilogram one as opposed to the 5 kilogram one? Or am I just getting a giant freaking bonus of being able to measure more? And they wouldn't get back to me. So, and I wasn't even that vague. I said, is the 30 kilogram slower than the 5 kilogram one? Is it technically less accurate than the 5 kilogram one? Is it all these things? And no response. So if anyone could tell me why, if it's the same price for a 30 kilogram and the same accuracy and it's all the same scale, the blank, the outside's all the same, what is the disadvantage of getting the one I got? Anyway, you guys have any ideas?
No idea.
No.
One disadvantage I can think of is that you have to order a much larger calibration weight to calibrate the big scales. Anyway, this is in from Ruben WTF on Instagram. You think that means that this person's name is Ruben, or they know someone like Ruben and they're like, yo, Ruben, what the what? You know what I mean? Like that. What do you think it is?
I think it's their name is Ruben.
But then, like, they're WTFing themselves?
Every day.
That's like when I wake up and I look in the mirror, I'm like, what the? Huh? Like that?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Question. I'm making peanut milk, in quotes, for a coffee shop, and it tastes great, but the issue is the shaking before use. I tried using sunflower lecithin in liquid at 1%, but it keeps separating. The recipe I'm using is 120 grams of roasted peanuts, 2.5 grams salt, 30 grams sugar, 10 grams of sunflower lecithin, 900 grams of water. Make the peanut butter with all the ingredients minus the water. Mix the water, filter through a milk bag. That was also my nickname. What else can I use to keep it as a homogeneous mix? Thanks. Love the show. Sorry to hear the bad news about the bar. You and me both, Ruben. So what you want to do is use the same product that I have in Liquid Intelligence for doing cold buttered rum and for orgeaz, and that is Ticaloid 210S. So in something that is going to sit for a long time, you need not just an emulsifier, so lecithin is an emulsifier, but you also need a light thickener slash stabilizer, right? And so the Ticaloid 210S, which by the way is available now from Modernist Pantry, that in fact they have over 10 of them in stock, I looked this morning, right? Ticaloid 210S is a mixture of gum arabic, the emulsifier, and xanthan, which is the stabilizer and the thickener, and I would use that at about 1.5%, okay? Now, If you don't want to buy or you can't, and by the way, I would try it without the lecithin, since I don't know how the lecithin will respond with the ticaloid. It'd probably be fine, but I would try it just with the ticaloid first. But the advantage of gum arabic to emulsify these things is, one, I know they work. I know it works. And two, it also keeps its emulsifying power over a wide range of temperatures and also a wide range of dilutions. So if you can't get the tick and the xanthan is like there and just, it just stabilizes the whole thing, not from an emulsification standpoint, but like literally by making a very weak gel so that the thing doesn't separate out. And those things shouldn't have to be shaken more than once every day or two. And then if you want to increase it that longer, you can add a little bit more. The nice thing is that, and if you don't want to buy 210S, the substitute that I use is a 9-to-1, right, mixture of xanthan and arabic. So that 1% of this stuff, 1% of a 9-to-1 would mean that you're using 0.9% of arabic and 0.1% of xanthan. Now, and at the rate I told you to use it, 1.5%, you're looking at about 0.15% of xanthan all day, which is thin. It's not going to get it all gloopy. But the nice thing is that you can keep dumping arabic in. It's not going to cause too much of a problem. So if you want it a little thicker, it's not going to hurt you, unlike a normal hydrocolloid, to go up to 2% if you need it. You know what I mean? And that's going to be about 0.2% xanthan, which you don't really want to go above 0.25% xanthan, especially with all that nut stuff, and it's going to start getting snotty. But that's what I would go ahead and do. Is that an okay answer?
Yeah.
All right. And if you're getting the arabic, don't get the garbage arabic. Get good arabic and get good xanthan. You're better off just getting the one from Ticaloid because it's, that you can get on a Monitor's Pantry. I mean, it's quote-unquote expensive, but you're not using that much of it. And it's pre-mixed, and they're very careful about matching like solubilities and the grind sizes and keeping the powders together. So, you know, if you can, and you can go to Monitor's Pantry and just get the actual Ticaloid 210 or 310. I originally used 310, but now they're pushing 210 for it. I would do that. Less heartache. It's always less, like when you're running something, it's always this thing, do I do it myself and potentially F up and then lose more, or do I spend a little bit more and save myself the heartache? I'd save the heartache in this case. This in from Seth McPhee on Instagram. I've been dying to find your lemon preserve recipe so I can recreate the Corsair cocktail. Now that I mourn the loss of existing conditions, I gotta know. Can you help someone out? P.S. I've made your gin and tonic famous on the Jersey Shore, clarified lime and all. Well, that's nice. I haven't been to the Jersey Shore in years. Stassi, you ever do the Jersey Shore thing?
Never.
Ever go down to Barnegat Light?
Is that a compliment that he's making on the Jersey Shore?
I love the Jersey Shore. You know, I lived in Jersey for a long time. Look, I never watched the TV show. So my idea of the Jersey Shore isn't the TV show. You know what I'm saying? Did you used to watch that TV show?
Nope.
I you know, like, there's a lot of fantastic communities on the Jersey Shore. A friend of mine used to have a house down in Ventnor, which is just south of Atlantic City, like just past the boardwalk on the beach. In fact, I lost my wedding ring in the surf there one time in the early 2000s.
Oh my gosh. Dave loses his wedding ring, he is convinced that women are checking him out.
I've never said that in my life.
Yes, you have.
I have never once said that.
Yes, you
have. I have never once said that.
How could I make that up? I remember it like...
You said that. I was like, I don't like to go around without my wedding ring. Doesn't equal that I think that people are checking me out. Like... I have never thought that anyone has ever checked me out.
Okay.
First of all, I believe the opposite of what you are saying. I believe that nothing gets you checked out more than putting a wedding ring on.
Okay.
Because it's safe. People can look at you if they know that you have a wedding ring on, or they're weirdos. I believe the exact opposite of what you're saying. Anyway, I have lost my wedding ring an inordinate number of times without ever taking it off my hand. I have lost the wedding ring.
Yeah, that was my confusion. So how do you do this?
So I've never removed, I shower with it, I've never removed my wedding ring. The first wedding ring I lost was I had just gone on, as we spoke a couple of episodes ago, on the Blunch diet, and I went from my getting married weight, which was, you know, like 190 or something, down to 155 pounds. I was like super thin, and so my hands got smaller. I went into the ocean, and it just washed off my hands. It, like, the water was cold. This was in Ventnor, and it came off my hands. I came out of the ocean with no wedding ring. The second time I lost my wedding ring, I was doing a sculpture, and it got crimped. It got crimped. My wedding ring was gold at the time, and it got crimped around my finger. And so I had to go get it cut off at the hospital. And then, which is why I no longer wear gold. I switched to stainless steel, right? Because Wiley Dufresne, my brother-in-law, he was like, you gotta go with a stainless steel because it's chef's metal. It's the chef's love of stainless steel, so I have a stainless steel ring. So I switched to stainless steel. That one, I don't know, I was washing dishes. There's two things. I was washing a lot of dishes down in New Orleans at Tales of the Cocktail, and that same day I had to like wash my hands in a trough and milk a cow for a William Grant party. We were all milking a cow. I don't know why we were milking a cow. I think they were making Ramoses or something with right out of whatever. And I looked up at my hand, wedding ring gone. And so I'm on my fourth one. I hope this one stays on. But anyway. Yeah, it's unbelievable how many times I've lost this thing considering I don't take it off.
This episode is brought to you by Vertera. Impressively versatile, stylishly sustainable, environmentally disposable dinnerware from Fallen Leaves. Vertera is a mission-driven company focused on making environmentally responsible, single-use products. Founded in 2006 on the belief that every culinary creation deserves a beautiful, sustainably crafted foundation, Vertera reclaims earthly discards like fallen leaves and tree scraps to design elegant, disposable dinnerware that elevates the look of food presentation. In short, a beautiful disposable plate that can go with your food to a composting facility. The team from Vertera recently made a huge pivot with their factories and started producing masks, gloves, sanitizer, and other PPE that food businesses need to safely reopen. Learn more at Vertera.com. That's Vertera.com.
We have an answer for your scale thing in the chat.
Do that, and then I'll talk about the preserved lemons.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Vengroth just wrote in, the scale thing could be binning. This is common with electronic components like CPUs. The idea is you build a bunch of something and test them. Some perform better than others, and you give them a better rating and sell them for a higher price, but you can still sell the lower performing ones for a lower price. I don't know enough about load cell performance characteristics to be sure, but I bet some are active enough percentage-wise, accurate enough percentage-wise to do 10 kilograms by 0.1 gram, while others have a higher percentage error and thus can only do 5 by 0.1 or even 1 by 0.1. It's better to bin them appropriately and sell them for a lower price than toss them in the trash.
Yeah, but I believe that the strange thing about it, and that's possibly true, the strange thing about it is they're all roughly the same price, which means that they're just not following their own logic. They should take the 30 kilogram scale or the 20 kilogram scale, and they should charge me like four times as much. You know what I mean? Like if it can do four times what the other one can, they should charge me more, and then only the people who need to measure that much would spend the extra money, right? But man, I believe that that's true when they're making them. It's just so weird that they don't, in fact, charge more, right? There's a slight, put it in this way, on eBay. So what you're doing on eBay is you're buying the last rev. Instead of the current rev of the scale, you're buying the last rev of the scale directly from importers in China. Same exact scale, same factory, right? And literally, like, the one that does 10 kilograms is, like, $58, and the one that does 30 kilograms is like $62, right? So it's like, hello, you know, it's like, why if there's no price penalty, why would I ever go with the lower one? Anyway, it is true, as I said, the calibration weights for a 30 kilogram scale are a lot more money, but whatever. So we're talking about the preserved lemon. So with preserved lemon, the trick with preserved lemon is first find the preserved lemon that you like, the one that we used both at Booker & Dax and at Existing Conditions. was the quote-unquote Moroccan preserved lemon that is made by Calustians in-house, right? So if my memory serves, it's got a little bit of a couple of saffron magillas in it, but it's mainly just preserved lemons with salt and not a lot of other like extra spices and whatnot. None, in fact. I think they had a couple of sprigs of saffron in it, but I can't remember. So it's just that. And then with the liquid and the entire lemon, the peel, the white, the pulp, everything, blend the entire thing into a chunky paste, right? And the trick here is you don't want to fully clarify. You're not going for a full clarification. So you do just SPL, right? I don't think we used D1 and D2 on it. But if you do, only do one round of it. Don't do two rounds of it, because you're not trying to get the thing completely clear. You're just trying to spin out like a lot of the chunky solid stuff so that it's thin enough to pour, but you want it to remain cloudy, otherwise your drink won't have the right body. And then just put it in the centrifuge and you're good to go. And that's what we used. And I don't have the spec off the top of my head, but it's a split-based, which I should, because it was my favorite drink to order and one of my better specs that I've ever done. But it's tequila, simple, dry on the simple side. I think it's like two, and then like half of simple. And then it's a split base on the citrus. So it's a half preserved lemon, half lime juice, and then spiciness. So the spiciness of your choice. The original was with Hellfire bitters. You know, I think it was 10 drops of Hellfire bitters. Shake. Oh, it wasn't a full 2 ounces though. Huh. I'll look it up. I'll look it up and give you the full spec. You might already have it, because I forgot. We made it smaller because it was so salty, and then we served it with the pony of Miller, the champagne of beers. I'll look it up, but not right now. Jeremy writes saying, "Hey Dave, love the show, inspiring me to try new stuff, infusing vodka with juniper berries, etc., which is AKA gin if you distill it. Dehydrated lime slices is the question. The first time I dehydrated lime slices, they turned out purple and got a nasty medicine smell. And the second time, they seemed to stay clear and smell good. I remember seeing the purple smelly type in a bar before the apocalypse hit. Any idea why the purple stank happens and how to stop it? Thanks." All right, first of all, Jeremy, instead of calling it a nasty medicine smell, you should call it like an awesome, complicated, fermented note. And then, if you call it that, well, that's a huge win. Then everybody wants it, right? If you call it a nasty medicine smell, right, on your menu, you're like, or if like you're serving to someone, you're like, this has a nasty medicine smell, people are going to be like, yeah, it does. If you're like, tell them it's awesome and complicated and fermented, they'll be like, this is awesome and complicated and fermented. Just a little trick for you. Secondly, I don't know exactly what's happening, but what I'm guessing is happening is that when you're dehydrating it, your rate of dehydration is not fast enough. And you are actually converting it into what is known, and you can go look this up, as black limes or lumi. So if you look these up, they're dehydrated citrus, lime, and they often go different degrees of purplish, brown, and black. And they're used as a spice when you pound them and grind them up in many cuisines, especially in the Middle East. And north of Africa. And so that is what that's typically used for. So I'm guessing if you increase your, not necessarily the heat, you don't want to cook it, although that's probably not going to make it turn. I would say just increase the rate at which you're dehydrating, and that's going to help. But check out uses for black limes and lumi and see whether that's what's going on. If you want to look up black limes in general, I recommend the article Mechanical Processing and Temperature Effect on Lime Shrinkage by A. Fadavi, wherein they describe exactly how to prepare your own black limes. Was that a okay answer? All right. Steve Yoon, as we know him, the fish poet. Hey, Stas, can you pull up somehow, or John, can you pull up the fish poem? Because I need to hear it again. I'm feeling. Yes. Did you guys see today a bunch of studies came out about depression rates due to COVID? I mean, it's just, I mean, we knew it was going to be bad.
That can't be true. That can't be.
You read it?
Nobody's depressed during COVID.
No, but did you read, like, like between 18 and 24, this study, and this is unbelievable, but like 1 in 4 people between 18 and 24 have had serious suicidal ideation. I mean, like much, I knew it was going to be bad, but I kind of didn't think it was going to be that bad. So I think also, John, towards the end, I know especially in our industry, a lot of us were hit with our jobs, and especially if we're in hospitality, not being able to provide that hospitality or have that human contact at home is really, really, really difficult. So at the end, I think we should put out the suicide prevention hotline number again. And just remember that, especially if you're young, this is what I've... So I was thinking about this. The younger you are, right, the bigger a chunk of your life this is, and the less you can see your way out of it, right? At 49, this is terrible, right? This is awful. And from a social standpoint, this is the worst thing, you know, ever, right? But at 49, it's still a lot shorter than it is for my son, who's 18, right? Where this is a huge kind of chunk of their life. And you know, so it's, A, if you're young, remember that, you know, just remember that this is finite. This, what's happening here is finite. You know what I mean? And if you're older, like me, just remember that people who are younger won't necessarily see it this way. And so we'll put out that and just watch out. Even though you can't physically be with each other right now, you should be watching out for each other. I couldn't believe those stats when they came
in. Real quick, I'm just going to mention the number now and something else like that. People don't have to wait until the end of the episode. If you are feeling that way, call 1-800-273-8255, 800-273-8255. That's the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. And if you are in the industry and just looking for resources, you know, to help you out with this kind of stuff, there's a great Facebook group called Chefs with Issues that's run by Kat Kinsman. And if you look up Kat Kinsman, she also has another tremendous amount of resources out there. So yeah, you're definitely not alone, and there is help.
Yeah, you're not imagining it. You're not at home. This is a terrible time, but I mean, you're not alone. But this, there are people that want to help you. You can get help. Please do, and please, those of you that, you know, aren't feeling this way, please look out for people, because it's a lot worse now than it was 6 months ago. A lot worse. Okay, now do you have the fish poem to make me feel a little bit better or no?
Oh, are you feeling down, Dave? Yes. Ready?
What the hell's that about?
I had sushi from a chef who developed a technique for aging fish. I got to try some of this, an amberjack kanpachi.
Oh my God, so good.
So good. One of the best poems I think I've ever read, and I'm a poetry major from Stanford.
Yeah, can you give it to me one more time?
I had sushi from a chef who developed a technique for aging fish. I got to try some of this, an amberjack kanpachi.
Oh my God.
So good.
I need permission to put that in the next book.
Or on a shirt.
Or on a shirt. Or like, but like, you know how like, okay, let's be honest with each other. You know how people put the little poem at the front of the chapters,
yes,
of the books that they write?
Yes.
How often do you understand why that poem was chosen? Or understand anything about it?
Well, I read nonfiction, and so usually it's tied in. Also, like, a lot of biographies put little poems, and it's usually tied in.
I know, but so, like a lot of times, most of the time you understand exactly what they're, yes, getting at with the poem? Yeah. Me, not so much. Me, maybe I'm at, like, 60%. Like, 40% of the time, I'm like, that the meaning of the poem is ambiguous to me, and then I have to read the chapter to figure out what the author was thinking about that poem. It just confuses the hell out of me. But this poem, I believe, everyone understands the meaning. Amberjack?
Yeah.
Genius. Genius work. Steve's question was, every year I throw a Thanksgiving for friends who can't be with family, and I'd have 20 or 30 people over. This year, I'm trying to brainstorm what's possible for doing a socially distanced Thanksgiving.
Wait, Dave, you know what my answer to this was? I just see underneath what my answer to is this email I got from him. That's with the poem, right? I just said, hey, Steve, what the F is this?
Wait, that's what you said when the original poem came in?
Yes.
But then once you realized it was poetry and not a question, then you were like, sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry, one more time. I got to hear it. It's just making me feel good.
All right. I had sushi from a chef who developed a technique for aging fish. I got to try some of this in Amberjack, Kenpachi.
It's like, what's amazing about it is that, like, I don't usually like free verse. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not a free verse kind of a guy.
Yeah.
But like, and it doesn't, I don't think, I mean, you're the poetry person, you tell me. It doesn't have, like, a meter, right?
No, it doesn't.
But, like, but somehow the flow of it is perfect anyway, even without a meter or a rhyme structure, right?
Right, yeah.
Because yeah, the form of it is such that I assumed it was meeting some sort of standard
structure
that I just didn't know about.
Yeah.
Well, I think Steve's hit on some as yet unknown metrical structure for...
This is the first one.
Yeah, for poetry. And I think this needs to be analyzed for its meter. And then
he
we
should
can
do
make more of that.
He should do a tour.
Yeah. Yeah. But like you couldn't change any of it and have it work.
No.
You know what I mean?
No.
And also, like, it's like Amberjack, Kenpachi.
And then
it's like,
parentheses, Kenpachi. It's like, yeah.
yeah. All right.
And he said, like, his response to my what the F was, sorry, I pressed send too soon. But at the end of that poem, it says Steve Yoon, Los Angeles, California. So I don't believe he pressed send too soon because it even looks like a poem is written, how a poem is written, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to have to trust you, Nastasia, to format it correctly for the poetry universe, and then we'll try to get permission.
No, I think it's already formatted. I will send it to you, Matt. Maybe you can, like, make it the image of our show today.
Yeah, and then, you know, we'll get it on T-shirts and, you know, whatever. Like, you know, it's obviously it's copyright Steve Yoon, but whatever. We'll work on it. We'll get the permissions. We'll do it. We'll do whatever we need.
That sounds great.
Yeah. So anyway, back to his question. So he's going to try to do a socially distanced Thanksgiving for 20 to 30 people. And by the way, we're going to have to start talking about this Thanksgiving stuff early for questions, because this is going to come up a lot. And, you know, the question he's about to have. And we should have some good answers for people. I don't even know. You're going to be in California for it. So you're going to try to actually see your parents, right, Nastasia?
Yes, for an unknown amount of time.
Yeah, I am. I'm not going to be able to see my parents at all. Like, even though they're only like an hour from here, they won't get anywhere near. They won't get anywhere near anyone. You know what I mean? So, yeah, I don't know what's going to happen. What are you guys doing? Do you know yet?
I'm trying to do what Nastasia's doing. I'm going to try and see my parents for an unspecified amount of time, like around Thanksgiving through Christmas, maybe. But that's a long time to be with my family for that one stretch of time.
I rented a house, John. So I'm not. Freaking.
Yeah, I need to figure out how to like quarantine myself or get tested in an appropriate amount of time or something like that, because I definitely don't want to risk getting my parents sick.
Yeah. All right. So Steve is saying he's going to work on pre-packaging dinners, dropping them off or having friends pick them up off the porch, and then having dinner together over Zoom. I might give each friend two containers, one for hot foods to microwave, and one for cold foods. Now, you know what the best thing, Nastasia, to separate the hot container and the cold container is?
Your book.
Copy of Liquid Intelligence. So if you don't already own Liquid Intelligence, now is a good time to order it before Thanksgiving to separate your hot food from your cold food. And that is all it's ever been to Nastasia. Although, you know, I could...
Never opened it.
I could be... You know what? I hate to do this because it's going to hurt my sales, but it would be this, like... cheaper maybe, or about the same price, to just go get a piece of styrofoam from the Home Depot, like, you know, with a blue board, and cut it to the same size as Liquid Intelligence, and then put it in between, and it'll be a lot lighter. But
now, I think,
you
know, it's better when it's your book and people are like, is that Dave's book? And I'm like, what? I don't know.
So back to the hot food, cold food. I assume this means crispy turkey skin is not happening. Or is it? Are all crispy foods not happening? Does this mean roasted Brussels sprouts are out of the question as well? Do you have any ideas on what Thanksgiving foods would store, transport, and reheat with decent results? If I got foil food containers, could I reasonably expect everyone to reheat them in the oven? Would that make crispy foods possible? Well, I'm glad, Steve, that you asked this question, because for the Harvard Public Lecture and for the Miracle of Moisture Management, I was indeed just running experiments on what aluminum pans do in the oven. And here's what might surprise you. First of all, your main problem is going to be you don't know what, obviously they can't put the aluminum pan guaranteed into the microwave. What's not true is that metal can't go in a microwave. That's a lie. The problem is that, one, the metal will shield the food that's inside of it, so it just won't get that hot. Only the microwaves can only come in from the top. And two, it's very likely that if there's any points or creases or places where two pieces of metal come close to each other, that they will arc like a demon. And when they arc, it gets real nasty, the smoke, the food, all kinds of issues. Not of cooking related, all kinds of like electronic issues. And this is why people tell you not to put foil or things into the microwave. But that foil and metal is completely incompatible with a microwave is incorrect, because think about it this way. The outside of your microwave is made of what? Metal, right? In fact, the whole thing is shielded in metal. But I digress. One of your main problems is going to be you don't know what kind of ovens people have. And so people are going to be having wildly different experiences. But about the thing about aluminum is this. I just ran an experiment this week where I took and I did this because of a lot of playing around I was doing with my infrared thermal camera, which I'm using to test cerezols with, and I was looking at aluminum pans. And when you look at an aluminum pan or a stainless steel pan with an infrared camera, what you'll see is your own reflection. Because in the infrared, which is where a lot of the radiant heat is, that's where most of the energy in radiant heat is, in the infrared, these pans are almost perfect mirrors. They reflect everything. And what that means, and you all know this from cooking, is that if you put, let's say you're making pizza or some sort of roll or something, and you put them on an aluminum sheet tray, you don't get a lot of coloring on the bottom of your product. It doesn't burn. It stays blonde. So for something like a cookie maybe that you want to stay blonde, this is an advantage. You're shunting away all the radiant heat with your aluminum pan. If you want to make something crispy, like a panned pizza, like a Detroit or Chicago panned pizza, everyone says go black. And in fact, I spray painted. Don't use spray paint, because even the high heat spray paint doesn't really work in the oven. It gets all gummy and it's not food grade. Don't do it. Please don't do it. But if you spray paint the exact same aluminum pan black on both sides, you get great results. It crisps it up great because that aluminum pan, which is very thin, conducts heat very well from the oven, and also it's collecting all of that radiant heat and dumping it into your food. Now, here's the interesting part. I was like, okay, let me test this. I did another aluminum pan, spray painted black just on the inside, on the part that's touching the food. And then I did another pan, spray painted black just on the bottom side, the part that's facing the oven. And the one that's sprayed just on the bottom performs almost identically to the one that's black on both sides. So really, all you need is the bottom of the pan to be black in order for it to get the results that you want of radiant heat all around. Problem is, you can't spray paint the bottom of these cheap aluminum foil pans black, but what you can do, and I haven't run the test yet, is you can buy fairly cheaply at B&H Photo or Adorama or any photo supply shop near you something called Rosco. That's like R-O-S-C-O, Rosco Cinefoil. And Cinefoil is a matte black aluminum foil that it's a lot more expensive than aluminum foil. I think a 1 foot roll is, I think, like $10, right? And that stuff I know handles the oven well. I wouldn't say it's food grade, so I wouldn't put it in direct contact with the food. But I just had mine. I baked a potato in cinefoil for over an hour, and it didn't leak any color. It was fine. Nothing got transferred. So it's not good for food contact, but it's definitely good in the oven because it's meant to be contacted for lights. And I would say that wrapping cinefoil around the bottom of it before you deliver it would allow them to put it in the oven and have the thing crisp up. So that's what I would do. Also, here's another thing. I was running a test. See what you think. I'm going to test the Cooking Issues crew that we have live here. How many of you think you should wrap a potato in aluminum foil before you cook it?
Yes.
It depends on the results.
Okay. Well, what does that mean, John?
I don't know. Like if I'm making potato rolls or something like that, or gnocchi, I'm just going to bake it on a bed of salt and let as much moisture. Actually, even if I'm just doing a regular baked potato, I'd probably just pop it in there. If I'm doing a Novak potato, Matt? Then it's wrapped in foil. But
well, then it's room temperature. Yeah. Then you don't cook it at all. Exactly.
I never do bake potatoes, but if I was going to, I would have wrapped it.
Okay. So the Baked Potato Council tells you not to wrap the thing before you cook it, but they do tell you to wrap it afterwards. And I ran a bunch of experiments. Here's what's happening. If you wrap a potato, the explanations they give are not very good. If you wrap a potato in aluminum foil, right, you might think, well, I'm capturing the steam inside of the aluminum foil, and so I'm actually going to cook it faster, right? Because it's not having evaporative cooling; it's going to cook faster. And yes, like the jacket may not get as crispy, but it also won't dehydrate as much, and it'll cook faster. Wrong. What happens is that it cooks a lot slower than one that's just rubbed with oil and poked with a fork. Rub with oil and salt, poked with a fork, and put it in the oven. A lot slower. If you wrap that same potato in black cinefoil and cook it, that one cooks at the same rate as the one that is cooked with no coating at all. And the difference is that the one that's wrapped in aluminum foil is reflecting away all of the radiant energy from your oven. This is also the reason why I'm guessing that if you put a lot of baked potatoes in your oven, they take so much longer to cook, and I think it's because they're occluding themselves from the radiation, from the radiant energy from the oven, and not, as you might have assumed, because somehow your oven can't handle it in the way that a microwave can't handle it. And also why, when you're cooking a potato, you want the maximum amount of radiant heat hitting it, so you don't want to put an aluminum pan underneath. And in fact, you can buy now pan liners and oven liners that go on the bottom rack of your pan to catch things that are black. And if you do have a pan that's going to go underneath something like a baked potato, like on the rack underneath and then cook it on the rack above, make sure that pan is black. This one needs to be black on both sides because you want it to absorb from the bottom and then radiate out again. Make any sense? Make sense?
Yes.
Little preview from the miracle of moisture management. All right. John Dunn wrote in, sorry to hear about the bar. I visited last summer. I was hoping to make another trip as soon as traveling isn't completely terrifying. I tracked down an online version of Pie Marches On off the halfitrust.org. Pie Marches On, I love that book. John loves that book. Nastasia is sick of hearing about that book. And that's the whole story, right, John?
Yep, exactly.
But you think it's a great book too,
it
right?
It is, yeah. I've been enjoying the copy that I ordered. Not the original, but like a repro from that was shipped from India.
Yeah. But it's okay quality?
Yeah. Wish the paper was a little better quality, but whatever I paid.
Only a fool, in terms of what pie you're going to start with, only a fool wouldn't start with, and I quote, the king of all pies and, quote, the most sensational pie that has ever been introduced, the black bottom pie, which sounds like the band. What was the name of the band from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou that George Clooney was fake in? Anyone remember? Hopefully and unlikely bypass the hammer, I'm going to claim that I have only one question. And it was, you don't feel good about that, right, Styles? People trying to bypass you?
Whatever.
What is meant by best quality chocolate? Is that unsweetened cocoa, baking, dark milk? And overall, there doesn't seem to be that much chocolate in the pie, only 2 ounces of chocolate for 6 pies. Would you increase this to get a better chocolate flavor? There's something about very specific instructions, but I'm not going to get into that because I didn't look at that. And no, I have not made that pie yet. My wife wants me to make that pie. That's the next one on the list back when I get into pie making modes. But I will say this about chocolate, and I am never above quoting my man Monroe Boston Strauss. Chocolate cream pie. The proper amount of chocolate is a point which I cannot definitely determine for you, due to the many brands and grades of chocolate and cocoa being used in pie work. So the amount suggested may be changed to suit your individual requirements as to flavor and color without any detriment to the finished pie. If a dark cocoa is used, less than the amount indicated will be necessary. Half cocoa and half chocolate can be used if you wish, or these can be blended in any other proportion. The important thing to remember in connection with cocoa or chocolate is that it must be added to the milk and cooked in the mix and should never be added after it is removed from the fire, although the latter procedure is followed by many uninformed bakers. So I did look at the recipe, and it is quite a small amount of chocolate. And normally, in the like in this internet world of blah, 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 I would say, yeah, the guy probably did a misprint or he's wrong. But this guy is so on point with his recipes that I would say it's worth going ahead and trying the recipe as he wrote it. I would use a dark, if he's subbing in cocoa, I would say he's going for basically Baker's. There's enough sugar in there, so I would use a good quality unsweetened is what I would go with, because I think that's probably what he was using, and that's going to get the maximum chocolate flavor. So I would try using something unsweetened, or if you want to use something that's like 72, just do a back calculation on assuming that, you know, that the part that's not 72, i.e. 28% of it is sugar, and then remove that amount of sugar and up the amount of chocolate to get the cocoa solids and butter where the recipe says. And I would try doing it that way and trust him once. And then, as he says, you know, to paraphrase him, if you like more chocolate, add more chocolate. I'm not going to stop you, right? Anyone? Anyone? From Stella Brown via email. Hey, Anastasia, Dave, and etc. Ooh, John and Matt are etc.
I mean, I've been crediting us as the rest ever since you threw that out there a while ago.
Well, that's just, wait, which one of you has a bird?
Me. Sorry, I'll kill it.
I love the bird. But you have it in your house? There's a bird in the Hamptons house? What kind of bird is it? Is it a budgie?
I don't know what it is.
Is it dead now?
Dead now.
Is it have like a nice color, or is it like a? Is it a bird in a cage in the house?
No, it's not.
Oh, it's just an outside bird?
Yes. I'll mute.
No, why? I don't mind the bird.
Because I'm sure it doesn't sound good to Matt.
No, yeah, ambiance is really nice in here right now. Also, we got to go pretty soon.
We do have to.
Someone, yeah, I got this one last question. Someone last night on the Zoom call, like, was in some sort of forest paradise, and so like it's always there are crickets going, and I was like to Jen, I was like, are there freaking crickets here in the Lower East Side? We never hear crickets, and she's like, nah, it's coming over the Zoom. I'm like, oh, okay. So it's nice, you know, when you're in the city to hear a little bit of nature, even if it's, you know.
I thought Nastasia was touring a cavern of crickets earlier.
Really? You heard crickets earlier?
There are crickets a lot here.
I recently tried the Blender Muddle Geranium cocktail Dave talked about the other week with my giant potted rose geranium, and it was revelatory. Well, thank you. I had been wondering if you could use the leaves in a cocktail, so I was excited to try it out, and now I'm addicted to blender muddling. It also works great with marigold leaves, and I want to try it with bee balm. A.K.A. Monarda. I've heard of Bee Balm, but I've never heard of Monarda. You ever heard that one, Stas?
No.
Nope.
I'm collecting in southwest Wisconsin in the Driftless region. Where's the Driftless region? Do you know about this? Any of you guys Wisconsin specialists?
No.
No.
I'd like to use it in a cocktail for an event in October, and I'm wondering what the best way to preserve it is. Can I muddle it now and keep the liquor I'm using gin for a month or so? Or should I freeze the leaves and make it right before service? I haven't frozen herbs before, so any pointers on that would be much appreciated as well. Thanks for the advice, Stella Brown. All right, do not make the liquor ahead of time. And like you, I have never tried freezing the stuff beforehand for the simple reason that we were working in a bar service, and there's no way that I could make sure that the leaves never thawed before they made it into the drink. And if the herbs thaw at all before they make it into your drink, they're going to get all nasty. So what I would do is I would try freezing them and just make sure that you can keep the stuff frozen prior to service. So if you're doing them at an event, right, like I would freeze them and then keep them in zippies with like a little bit of dry ice in a container next to where you are so that they stay crispity frozen. But do yourself a favor and run a test beforehand. So like, you know, pick some herbs and do the fastest freeze that you can do. The easiest would be, you know, a single, like try seeing whether a single layer on a sheet pan in your freezer freezes them fast enough. If that works, great. After they're frozen, quickly throw them into a zippy, put them back in the freezer and let them stay that way. Pull them out in a week, and if they're still good in a week, they'll be good in a month or 2 months. You won't be a problem, right? As long as your freezer doesn't go down. If that doesn't work, then you can try a more aggressive kind of freezing with like salt ice baths and stuff like that, or you know, if you were lucky enough, like a little bit of LN or dry ice to freeze it down at the beginning just to get a faster freeze rate. But I'm guessing that that will work, especially I don't know with those herbs how much polyphenol oxidase activity they have, so I don't know how brown they're going to go. So you might be lucky, like certain herbs can be frozen and then used relatively quickly with almost no deterioration. I'm looking at you, parsley. But the problem with parsley is that in a blender muddle drink, it tends to settle very quickly. So like if you blender muddle or nitro muddle parsley and you let the drink sit around for like 15 minutes, you'll get like a clearish green and then the parsley will have settled to the bottom, which is not what you want. I don't know why some herbs do this and some herbs don't, but it's an interesting phenomenon. But I would run a test, and please, if you do run a test, please give us the results so that we can use your work to help out other people. How's that? We got all the questions. We actually did all the questions.
Wow.
What do you think?
What? So show's canceled forever?
What, because we made it through all the questions? Yeah, that's it. Yeah, it's over.
We're done. Cooking issues is over.
It's
all right,
over.
See you, people.
That's what I tell the kids. I tell the kids, I'm like, you know, if you ever wanted to murder me, if you ever want me to just fall over dead, and your mom too, all you need to do is do what we ask you without talking back. And then that would be it. You know what I mean? Like, if we just said, go walk the dogs, and they did it without saying later or blah or complaining, I will fall over dead. You know what I mean? So it's like, same thing with the cooking issues. If I ever actually get through all the questions, I have few enough tangents that I make it through all the questions, show's over. It's
yeah.
Over.
Yeah. All right. Well, it was a good run.
It was a good run. I hope you guys enjoyed it while it lasted. Cooking Issues.
Cooking Issues is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody. I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.